This is the rehearsal speech for the House of Sky talk to be delivered in Corvallis and in Boulder. The first words out of me tonight regarding this House of Sky need to be simply thank you to all of you who have spent time with my book for this community read occasion. When I began in the writing trade, as a young Western workhorse harnessed to a newspaper job, I dreamed ahead to somehow joining one or another of the literary lineages aboard Shakespeare's Ark, the lions of narrative, the foxes of mystery, the griffins of science fiction and fantasy, the watchful herons of history, the gazelles and dolphins of poetry, the badgers of biography, the lop-eared leopards of memoir. Little did I imagine that I would go up that gangplank to end up as a piece of homework. My own assignment in all this is to try to tell you in about the next 40 minutes the makings of a book that took me 2.5 years to write. A blow-by-blow account, therefore, has the risk of keeping us here for years on end. So, I'm going to try some shortcuts, and as you know, shortcuts sometimes run perpendicular to common sense. But it simply feels right to me to start tonight with some of the craft of writing that went into this House of Sky that was deliberately flexed onto some of those pages by me with lyrical intent premeditated, because any piece of writing that lasts casts a longer and more meaningful shadow than its maker. Then I'll see if I can bring up a few roots of how and why this kind of writing evolved into this kind of book. And finally, since this is the silver anniversary year of this book and me, probably some accounting of our life together is due. When I get done with talking out loud about what I thought I was up to and trying to make words speak forever on silent paper, I warned you we're going to be out of range of common sense here, I'll be glad to try to field any questions you might have. In the beginning is the language. That's what stories are ultimately about, whether they're in the form of a book or television or film or now on computer. We live by stories. Our own memories are the stories we tell ourselves. And what's magical about stories is the way they're told, about the language always trying to excel itself, say something in a new way, say, hey, listen to this. Looking back at the diary I kept during the writing of this House of Sky, I find that I was determined to make the language dance in this book. In those diary pages are musings and urgings to myself to always push the language toward unexpected beauty. As I said to myself at one point, to try to make each sentence of the book have a trap of poetry within it. The opening page of this House of Sky, not coincidentally, shows this. I wanted the book off to a fast, stylistic start. And so, for example, there is this description of a Montana creek. The single sound is hidden water, the South Fork of 16 Mile Creek diving down its willow-masked gulch. The stream flees north through this secret and peopleless land until, under the fir-dark flanks of Hatfield Mountain, a bow of meadow makes the riffled water curl wide to the west. At this interruption, a low rumble of the mountain doles itself up watchfully, and atop it, like a sentry box over the frontier between the Sly Creek and the prodding meadow, perches our single-room herding cabin. Okay, a few of the things that I hope are going on in those three sentences. The verbs are out of the ordinary, way out. The stream flees. The meadow makes the ruffled water curl wide. And then a little innovation, which has won me a lot of admiration and condemnation, the use of a noun as a verb. A low rumble of the mountain knolls itself up, as if the mountain terrain itself were a living part of this story, as I wanted to imply. A couple of other things that aren't there by accident. The modifiers, the adjectives in particular, aren't bashful. Willow-masked gulch, fir-dark flanks, the riffled water, the sly creek, and the prodding meadow. This is not your stripped-down Hemingway style, which was the expected mode in writing about the American West back in the 1970s, when I was putting this book together. Finally, let me mention a dab of rhythm there on the page. The single sound is hidden water. I can't remember how deliberate that was, but certainly semi-consciously, there's a familiar rhythm from poetry. The single sound is hidden water. Of a certain generation, we probably all learned something like that rhythm best from Robert Frost. Whose woods these are, I think I know. This poetic urge that crops up in my books, particularly in my nonfiction, is one of those roots that I'll tenderly pull up here for a minute and try to explain. As squarely as I can look at myself and the kind of writing I've produced, which on the one hand relies on dogged research and on the other fancy flights of words, I seem to be either something like a poet yearning to be a clerk or a clerk fumbling around with poetry. In either case, I can tell you poetic leanings caught up with me in an unexpected place, while I was working on a PhD in history. What graduate school taught me back there in the late 60s was that I didn't have what it took to be on a university faculty. I found myself freelancing magazine articles during grad school at the University of Washington, just as if I didn't have any seminar papers due. And I also began, to my complete surprise, writing poetry, which I had never even thought of attempting before. My 8 or 9 published poems showed me that I lacked the poet's final skill, the one Yeats called closing a poem with the click of a well-made box. But still wanting to stretch the craft of writing toward the areas where it mysteriously starts to be art, it was back then that I began working on what I later heard Norman MacLean call the poetry under the prose. And that's what those stretching verbs and unabashed modifiers and the knoll getting up out of nounhood and doing a jig are about there on the opening page of This House of Sky. Besides what might kindly be called my own lyrical propensity, there's also what I call a poetry of the vernacular in how my characters speak on the page. Where does that come from? Well, accompany me back to age 10 and listen to a voice that has never left me. You're not sugar nor salt nor nobody's honey, so the rain will never hurt you, she croons to me. That one goes around looking like she's been yanked through a knothole backwards, she huffs about our worst-dressed neighbor. And she confides about the couple dallying together in our wide-eyed little town. Those two are as close as 3 in a bed with 1 kicked out. Into my life had come that river of proverbs, my grandmother. I was 10 years of age, but my ears were as old as sin. All of a sudden, I knew I was in new territory of life, something like honorary adulthood. Now, besides my Scotts-Burr storytelling widower father, Here was my mother's mother in this reluctant knot of bloodline they had made to raise me. So, you bet, my ears were busy from then on with the picture play of words from my grandmother, whose formal education had broken off at the third grade. Whenever the prairie wind would swirl up her dress and she would announce, "Balloon ascension!" Or with the bloodstream music of rhyme, when my father, from the heights of his eighth grade education, would ask, "Have they taught you this one yet?" and begin reciting to my dropped jaw, "Hiawatha." People who are poor in all else are often rich in language. The everydayness of that pair of imaginative tongues I grew up around, my father and my grandmother, must have drilled that into me, because starting with this book, I've always tried to attain a language which makes a shimmer behind the story. The appeal, the wonder of the vernacular of people's lives coming through. Any kind of work has its own vocabulary, its poetry under the prose, and people are dauntingly eloquent at it. I found that time and again as I went around with my tape recorder when I was doing the research for this House of Sky. Here's a quick sample from my dad's buddy, Clifford Shearer. About the time the two young men from Montana got it into their heads to come out here to the coast to seek their fortunes at a sawmill on Gray's Harbor. And I think you can hear how Clifford's own words help build this little story. "Charlie and I didn't know what a stick of lumber was, hardly. We thought everything was made out of logs, you know. But they asked us if we knew anything about lumber. We said, well, sure." That couple of sentences from Clifford are at least my notion of a writer's winning day at the racetrack. They compress the background my father and Clifford came out of, the era of notched log homestead cabins. My father was born in one. Clifford's family, about a dozen of them, fetched up from Missouri and one in the coulee next door to the Doigs. And they capture the bravado of those footloose young men. Sure, you bet. Hell, they knew all about lumber. And at the same time, they remind us that there was a time in this country when you could get away with something like that, be hired off the street on your word, and then be let to prove yourself. It would have taken me immensely more words than Clifford's to portray all that he did, just by telling me in his own rough eloquence how things seemed to him. Any of us who have ever looked closely at our family photo albums know that, genetically speaking, we are not so much ourselves, but piecework of those before us. Writers, too, have lineage, heritage. The writing that makes books out of lore and lingo is a craft that has to be learned and worked at. And one of the ancestors I chose upon becoming a working writer was waiting for me there in the pages of his sea stories, Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad, of course, is famous for the sweep of his rhetoric, the oceanic power of his sentences. Every literary critic knows that. But it seems to me what they either don't know or are too bashful to say out loud is something else that Conrad was just as terrific at: quick characterization. In Conrad's great Storm at Sea story, Typhoon, which features the most literal-minded, phlegmatic hero in literary history, Captain McWhirr, who outlasts the typhoon by not having enough imagination to get scared, there's the one-sentence summary of the captain's wife. The only secret of her life was her abject terror of the time when her husband would come home to stay for good. That's all we ever know about Mrs. Captain McWhirr, but it's an entire portrait. It's a whole life in that one sentence, isn't it? Given that kind of example, I try, with all the craft in me, to make the minor characters in my books vivid, to make them behave as memorably in my pages as Laurence Olivier once said, each actor in a play must contribute to the play as a whole. The third spear carrier on the left should believe that the play is all about the third spear carrier on the left. Here's a quick portrait of the pair of neighbors my grandmother and I had when we lived in that wide-eyed little town of Ringling, population about 45 then and less now. Our house not only didn't have running water, it didn't even have a well. And so we carried all our water by bucket from next door, from the house of this memorable couple, Kate and Walter Badgett. There were enormities about the Badgetts which somehow seemed to bolster us simply by existing so near at hand. These began with size and age and went on through manner. Side by side, the two weathered figures loomed like barn and silo. Kate was pillowed in fat, so wide that she seemed to wedge apart the arms of the huge easy chair where she spent her days. Atop that crate of a body was an owlish face and a swift tongue that could operate Walter all day long, still have time to tell what the rest of Ringling was doing. On her desk by the front window, which looked across the tracks to the gas station and post office store, Kate kept her pair of binoculars. Who had come to town, for how long, and maybe even what they bought? It all came up the magnifying tunnel of vision to Kate, and then went out with new life, as if having added to itself while re-echoing through that bulk of body. Then, in some mid-sentence of hers, Walter would appear from one or another of his chores, in his pauseful way looming tall as a doorway and nearly as still, a rangy, silent sentinel with great hands hung on poles of arms. With Walter Badgett paused there in memory, let me just mention one further decision of craft that shaped the pages of this book, and then traipse off to dig at roots a bit. I can't emphasize enough that the decisions of language I've been giving you samples of, and this next one, are the doings of a professional writer. I was 39 by the time this House of Sky was published, and I had worked at the writer's trade some 20 years by then. My byline already was on more than 100 magazine articles, and those 8 or 9 fugitive poems. My wife and I had written a journalism textbook together. A full-time freelance writer, as I was after leaving newspaper work and a magazine job and belated graduate school, awaits not the tides of inspiration, but those of perspiration. The workaday patience of one of the odd patron saints of our trade, the late Flannery O'Connor, has always guided me in the long devotion of the writer's backside to the seat of the chair where he or she sits and works. The fact is, said Flannery O'Connor, that if you don't sit there every day, the day it would come well, you won't be sitting there. And so, sitting there trying to coax the past to talk, I determined that memory needed its own voice in this book. Memoirs, and I very much consider this House of Sky a memoir rather than an autobiography, as I'll get to in just a minute. It began as a book about my father and his times. Memoirs have to be the essence of a life, instead of, say, a framework, as in biography. Great memoirs such as Midnight Oil by V.S. Pritchett, or Bronx Primitive by Kate Simon, or Sorrowless Times by James Herndon, have never hesitated to give a version of conversations that happened decades ago. There's no other way you can convey the sound of the people you're writing about, the patterns of their talk, the habits of their sayings. My training as a journalist, though, made me uneasy not to have ground rules made plain to the reader when I was recovering conversations from persons no longer among the living. So I put the dialogue of this House of Sky into italics instead of quote marks to indicate that this is memory's version, that people's words were as accurately retrieved as I could possibly manage to do it across the distances of time and mortality, but necessarily not the absolute verbatim that we use quotation marks to indicate. Even the people from my family's past who were still around and talked into my tape recorder, and there were a couple of dozen of them in the pages of the book, I italicized their spoken words to me rather than presenting their version of things as though they were not mediated by memory. I also gave memory its own performance pieces in the book. The between chapter bursts of language and musing about the nature of remembering. Prism pieces, as I call them, as if the spectrum of memory was being reflected through these little crystal-like sections in speculations such as this one from the first of these prisms. If somewhere beneath the blood, the past must beat in me to make a rhythm of survival for itself, to go on as this half-life which echoes a second pulse inside the ticking moments of my existence. If this is what must be, why is the pattern of remembered instants so uneven, so gapped and rutted and plunging and soaring? I can only believe it is because memory takes its pattern from the earliest moments in the mind, from childhood. As you can tell, not only did these prism pieces give me a chance to ruminate about memory outside the narrative pace of each chapter, they let me improvise solos in as much of the music of words as I could manage. One of my favorite sayings about the creative process is from the great jazz trumpeter Louis Armstrong. "We all go do re mi, but you got to find the other notes for yourself." For better or worse, the memory prism pieces sent me off looking. Well, those are glimpses of the writer at work, if that's what sitting around in my own head for a couple of years at a time can be called. By what routes, though, did such word-making lead to this specific book, instead of, say, a chapbook of not very good poems, or one of those tremulous first novels in which actual people are as thinly disguised as if they've fallen into a vat of cellophane? This House of Sky now comes with an introduction in which I recite a lot of the chronology of how the book came to be. It was installed when the hardback version was reissued in a 15th anniversary edition, and it's up front in the paperback as well. I have mixed emotions about it being there, evidently for eternity now, because I think books should just speak for themselves, starting on page one. But the introduction in here at least shows some of what I was thinking, and publishers were thinking, as this House of Sky found its way into the world. But there are, beyond that, a couple of what might be called stray but strong roots to the making of the book that I can trace out for you a little now. The first goes back to a time when Rotarians flocked west by the thousands. I realize this conjures up wagon trains of guys singing the Rotary song over breakfast around the campfire on the Overland Trail. But that's not what I mean. No, in 1966, Rotary International chose Denver as the site of its annual worldwide convention. And as I at the time was the only Westerner on the staff of the Rotarian magazine in suburban Chicago, I was put in charge of the theme issue about the convention venue, i.e., at least as I defined it, the whole American West. For a young, restless, west-leaning wordsmith, my wife Carol and I were within months of lighting out for the West ourselves in our move to Seattle, being put in charge of that special issue of the Rotarian, here it is, in its Wandering the High West glory, was like someone with a sweet tooth being turned loose in a candy shop. I decided we'd do a photo essay on the Rocky Mountain States, and what better way to do that than blow the budget on a couple of Ansel Adams pictures? For Wyoming here, Tetons, Snake River, Thunderstorm. Can't get more iconic than that. And for New Mexico here, Aspens. And then pad out the other pages with three photos by Carol and state tourist bureaus. I commissioned articles right and left, including one on the historical flavor of the West from Vardis Fisher, after my original choice, Walter Van Tilburg Clark, told me he had hit writer's block on the topic. But of course, the absolute best stuff I assigned to myself. Those pieces seem to point a dozen years ahead in the general direction of this House of Scott. First were the captions for this photo essay, which I naturally wasn't going to let anybody else get near. How many times in life do you get to write the words for the work of Ansel Adams and your own bride in the same set of pages? But those captions turned out to be not what you might expect in the pages of the Rotarian magazine, because they're a kind of secret poem. The stanza with each picture is linked to the one on the next page with a repetition of word or image or allusion. For instance, the last line about the superstition mountains bespeaking nobility is followed by the first line of the next caption, "The mountains talk in wind." Only one of the other editors caught on to these linking allusions and half-rhymes and so on. He was the other closet poet on the staff, but he never broke loose from the Midwest to see where words could really take him. And so, there was this fancy piece of writing, poetry under the prosaic Rotarian approach, going out to a million Rotary Club members. But that wasn't nearly all, as long as I had my hands on that special issue. I also assigned myself a full-length piece about rodeo. As you can tell, writer's block wasn't anything I was worried about coming down with. And in the course of that piece, I wrote a few paragraphs about my father in his bronc-stomping days. Here's one. Corral, chutes, and bleachers were scarce on the Montana prairie 30 and 40 years ago, so the arena was formed by a circle of autos and horsemen. While some helpful soul eared down a bronc, holding the horse's ears to keep his head down, the rider climbed aboard. Then the bronc was turned loose, and the contest between man and beast went on until the man stopped riding or the beast stopped bucking. Madness? Yes, but according to the gleam in Dad's eye when he recounts such escapades, madness of a most thrilling sort. Now, you'll have noticed that I have mostly spared my father and my grandmother one more elucidation by me in this talk. I figure they exist in every page of the book, more vividly recreated there than I can do here. But I think it's significant that this rodeo piece was the first time I tried to write about my dad. Whatever the Rotarians thought, he loved the piece. He about wore out the magazine passing it around among the neighbors. After his death, 5 years later, the idea was more and more with me to try some sort of book about him and the times and tragedies that had shaped him in his Western generation. Right away, it hit me that it would also need to be a book about my grandmother in that rough but magical alliance of life they made together for my sake. And standing there next was the logic that I myself had better be in the book, because mine as the writerly voice was the strongest way I knew to tell the story of the three of us. How, though, do you keep out a piece of writing such as this book, which almost immediately turns into a piece of endless rewriting, over the years it takes? This next is an odd-flavored route, perhaps, this one of motivation. But I'm convinced it twines into the hours and days and years back there when I kept at the making of a memoir about people nobody had ever heard of at the time. It's admittedly not a source of motivation of the sort people might expect of a lyrically leaning writer. But to put it as frankly as I can, neither of them ever realized it. But two prime sources of inspiration to me through the publishing trends that they set in motion at the time were Lauren Bacall and Richard Nixon. After Bacall's best-selling autobiography of her life as an actress brought on the spate of books signed with names off movie marquees, an inundation that is still pretty much with us, and then there immediately came the almost simultaneous flood of lucrative book contracts to Watergate figure after Watergate figure. Well, I can't begin to describe what it does for you as a working writer, what it does for your level of concentration and determination to get up every morning and remind yourself Spiro T. Agnew is writing a novel. Not to put too fine a point on this, my reasons for working on this House of Sky were as many as my head could contain, but during those years, it was often on my mind that I didn't see why you should have to be a discredited and defrocked politician or a tinsel-haired entertainment star to be eligible to have your story told in this country. The story of Charlie Doig and Bessie Ringer and yours truly as their poet and clerk did get told, emphatically, I guess we have to say, since it's still around after these 25 years. And let me try to bring us home safe from the shortcuts with a few thoughts now about the apparent results of This House of Sky and some allied books about the West. With one exception, these are other people's thoughts. The first is that of Bill Beavis, who taught Western literature at the University of Montana and was very much part of the near-legendary writing scene in Missoula. In his selection of what he saw as pivotal books about the West, 10 Tough Trips, Beavis writes, "I was stunned when I read the opening page of This House of Sky. The style, tense and dynamic with strong verbs and nouns made into verbs. I've got him on the hook, haven't I? That style was dramatically imaginative and anti-Western, following the lead not of John Wayne, but of William Faulkner. Doig's prose declared that a Montanan could speak any way he or she pleased, that Western writing did not have to be silence, one-liners, and grunts." I'd actually already heard a shorter and more profound summary of how the Missoula gang was looking at This House of Sky. When I was signing books in a store there, looked up, find myself confronted with a barrel-chested figure proved to be William Kittredge. Bill Kittredge stuck his hand out for a handshake, told me, "Read your book. I just want to say, goddamn." Later, Bill and his invaluable role as the circuit-riding teacher and writer about the American West put some valuable perspective on what was happening between the pages back there in the mid-1970s. In 1974, James Welch's classic novel of reservation life, Winter in the Blood, appeared. In 1976, A River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean's mighty book. Then, as Bill sees it, 2 years later came the book we're talking about here today, which, as he put it, reaffirmed what everybody had been hoping and thinking, that there would be a real Western literature, not just shoot-em-ups. My own hope is that if this House of Skye has done any path-breaking, blindly enough, because I certainly didn't start off with any notion that it would have this kind of success heaped on it, it's along a line of chance-taking literature that I've been trying for, 15 years or so, to define as the eloquence of the edge of the world. I think we've been seeing this most strongly in the universe of fiction, where I hang my shingle these days. Writer after writer, whose work at first glance seems to be far away from the self-appointed literary capitals such as New York, London, Paris, the usual old suspects. But in fact, these writers, I believe, have moved the central power of fiction to where they are in the world. Writers who have originated in what the major metropolitan conglomerations of the world would consider to be the outback, the far corners, the back pockets of the planet. Nadine Gordimer, South Africa. Salman Rushdie, India. The Australians. My God, the Australians. David Malouf, Tim Winton, Thea Astley, Elizabeth Jolly, Rodney Hall, Thomas Keneally, to name just a sample. And up north, the Canadian writers such as Alice Munro and Michael Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood, whom I believe have more in common with this literary foreign legion than with the main literary camps down here on our side of the border, and V.S. Naipaul of Trinidad and Wole Soyinka of Nigeria, who have the first two Nobel Prizes among this group. The arrival of this new world class of writers out in the back pockets of the world, who in my opinion have proved that contemporary fiction can have character as well as characters, I think has had some significant reverberations for those of us trying to write about the reaches of the American West. There's the always useful reminder that we are not alone, that others too have faced landscapes dauntingly bigger than themselves, have come to terms with the remoteness, have been tempered instead of broken by hard times. Beyond even that, it may be that the eloquence of the edge of the world, that name for it is mine, although the constellation of ideas certainly doesn't belong to me, goes deep into what we have been and should be as Americans. I once heard the preeminent historian of colonial America, Bernard Bailyn, give the best speech I've ever heard about William Faulkner. And it wasn't even a talk directly about Faulkner. So imagine my gratification this spring when Bernard Bailyn's latest book, To Begin the World Anew, came out and proved to be about the American founding fathers as political artists on the periphery of their given world. Bailyn looks at Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and the framers of the Constitution in light of an essay by Kenneth Clark, the art critic those of us of a certain generation remember from his magisterial television series on the history of art called simply and grandly Civilization. Clark was himself as inbred, upper crust, snobby a Londoner as ever existed. I've always admired the lordly honesty of the opening page of his memoir about his Edwardian upbringing. My parents belonged to a section of society known as the idle rich, and although in that golden age many people were richer, there can have been few who were idler. But he had a ruthlessly honest eye for art, and in the essay that set Bailyn's mental gears to working, Clark proposes that fresh, powerful art comes, in essence, from the edges of the world when the old centers no longer hold. I'll quote just this paragraph. Artists on the periphery introduce simplicity and common sense to a style that has become too embellished, too sophisticated, too self-centered. The provincials, I prefer to think of us as edgewalkers, are concrete in their visualization, committed to the ordinary facts of life as they know them rather than to an established style that has taken on a life of its own. And they have a visionary intensity, which at times attains a lyrical quality as they celebrate the world around them and strive to realize their fresh ambitions. Balin applies this notion immediately to the politics of revolutionary America. The American founders were provincials, he writes, living on the outer borderlands of an Atlantic civilization whose heartlands were the metropolitan centers of England, France, the Netherlands, and Spain. From their distant vantage point, they viewed what they could see of the dominant order with a cool, critical, challenging eye. What they saw was something atrophied, weighted down by its own complacent, self-indulgent elaboration, and vulnerable to the force of fresh energies and imaginative designs. Refusing to be intimidated by the received traditions, confident of their own integrity and creative capacities, they demanded to know why things must be the way they are. They had the imagination and energy to conceive of something closer to the grain of everyday reality, more likely to lead to human happiness. I suppose one thing that tickles me about Bernard Balin's approach is that it turns our first great Americans into Westerners. By a little extension of Balin's thought, you can about see Tom Jefferson with a battered Stetson on, fishing the big Blackfoot River with Norman McLean's brother. But more than that, perhaps we can find some hope in the notion that the eloquence of our edge of the world, the energy of our periphery, has some shaping power on the order of things. As best I can put it together, then, this has been some of the craft, the ways and byways, and the points of arrival of this book that we're gathered around here today. But there's a last act to the story of the book, which, because it is actual, maybe sums up the making of this House of Sky better than any of my backward glancings ever can. After the manuscript was accepted for publication, and the publisher, Harcourt, was gearing up to put it into print, my editor called me to say we really didn't have a title for the book. Its working title, I'm reluctant to confess, had been Half-Life. You heard the phrase there in the snippet I read about the past as a half-life echoing inside the ticking moments of existence. And I was about halfway through the biblical allotment of 70 years at the time I was writing on the book. And I probably had other pallid reasons as well for resorting to that as a temporary title. Anyway, it wasn't news to me that we needed to do better than that. I scrambled for a couple of days, asking friends if they had any ideas for a good title, and pawing through the dictionary of quotations. My wife even polled her classes at the community college where she was teaching. To our astonishment, that cutting-edge generation of students came up with things along the lines of, "As the World Turns." Finally, I managed to think up, "In This House of Sky," which I liked the rhythm of. "Shorter is better," my editor said. "How about House of Sky?" I said, "How about this House of Sky?" "Perfect," my editor said. "Now we have a title, but we don't have any passage in the book that has anything to do with that title." "Okay, I'll write one," I said, without really thinking about what I was letting myself in for. The book, as I think you've gathered from my comments today, had been a staggering amount of labor. I'd been working on it across 6 years by then, and there were at least 1,000 solid days within that of just sitting at the typewriter, exerting at the language hour after hour, trying things out, changing them, rewriting. The first page of the book, where I read you the little dab about the creek, I figure I worked over at least 75 times in those years. And now, I had promised I would go back and graft a title scene into a finished book. I sat down to do it, not knowing how many days, weeks, I was going to have to struggle. And in an hour and a half, it was done. As if the rhythms and the poetry under the prose, the voices of the past and all the rest had come together and told me, here, say this. In the night, in mid-dream, people who are entire strangers to one another sometimes will congregate atop my pillow. They file into my sleeping skull in perplexing medleys. A face from grade school may be twinned with one met a week ago on a rainforest trail in the Olympic Mountains. A pair of friends I joked with yesterday now drift in arguing with an editor I worked for more than 1,000 miles from here. How thin the brain walls must be. So easily can acquaintanceships be struck up among these random residents of the dark. Memory, the near neighborhood of dream, is almost as casual in its hospitality. When I fix my sandwich lunch in a quiet noon, I may find myself sitting down 30 years ago in the company of the erect old cowboy from Texas, Walter Badgett. Forever the same as the meal with Walter, fried mush with dark corn syrup and bread which Walter first has toasted and then dried in the oven. When we bite, it shatters and crashes in our mouths, and the more we eat, the fuller our plates grow with the shrapnel of crumbs. After the last roaring bite, Walter sits back tall as 2 of the 10-year-old me and asks down, "Well, reckon we can make it through till night now?" I step to the stove for tea and come instead onto the battered blue enamel coffee pot and a sheepherder's wagon. My father's voice saying, "You could float your grandma's flat iron on the Swede's coffee." I walk back toward my typewriter, past a window framing the backyard fir trees. They are replaced by the wind-leaning jack pines of one Montana ridgeline or another. I glance higher for some hint of the weather, and the square of air broadens and broadens to become the blue expanse over Montana rangeland, so vast and vaulting that it rears in the foundation line of the plains horizon to form the walls and roof of all of life's experience that my younger self could imagine, a single great house of skies.